Part 2. Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. Go get honest work. To me, they're not a whole lot better than pimps or drug dealers in suits. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse on the Americans Aiding the Kleptocrats. Chapter 6. Scooping Caviar with a Shovel. When I was in Equatorial Guinea the first few weeks, I asked, "Why are there no newspapers?" And they said that the people weren't interested, that the people don't read a lot, which is also why there were no libraries. Former senior U.S. State Department official. For those in Washington, Riggs Bank, a small American bank founded in 1836, the same year Texas seceded from Mexico and Martin Van Buren was elected president, had always had a different air, a different aura about it. A small boutique outfit, Riggs pitched itself to clients in Washington as the Bank of Presidents, catering to diplomats, politicians, and their assorted retinues. And it had the legacy to back it up. Riggs could track its clientele back to Abraham Lincoln, having helped finance everything from the invention of the telegraph to the purchase of Alaska. It was one of the oldest banks in America's capital, and was, as one write-up described it, venerable. At the turn of the 21st century, that reputation remained intact. While other banking giants spun off in new directions, Riggs' clientele appeared localized to the power players in Washington and the foreign officials passing through. Riggs was seen as a small but powerful bank, cornering a niche market, one Senate investigator told me. They serviced embassies, heads of state and family members, other officials from other countries who were living in Washington. By one estimate, Riggs, at its height, worked with over 95% of the foreign missions and embassies in and around Washington. Embassy banking, they called it. As Riggs later said, they were happy to open an account for anyone holding diplomatic credentials from the U.S. State Department. Overseen by Joseph Allbritton, who'd served as the bank's director since 1981, Riggs' client list grew at a steady rate toward the end of the millennium, with its total assets reaching about $6 billion, enough to make it the largest bank based in Washington, though still far more boutique than, say, globe-spanning behemoths like Citibank. In comparison to other competitors, Riggs always remained small and always pitched itself as the cultured, elegant bank for its cultured, elegant clientele. Then, in early 2003, the mask slipped. While investigators in Washington continued tracking the roots of the 9/11 terrorists' financing, rumors began trickling out that they'd found links between Riggs and the suspicious Saudi money tied to the 9/11 attacks. Tens of millions of dollars connected to Saudi Ambassador Prince Bandar bin Sultan and his wife intersected with dozens of accounts they maintained at Riggs, as did numerous questions about Bandar's connections to key contacts for the 9/11 terrorists. But that wasn't all. Reports surfaced that Riggs had also gotten a taste for some of the dirty money that had spent years pouring into the U.S., probing for weak spots, and that some of that money was linked to a small, despotic government in Central Africa suddenly enjoying gushes of oil wealth, without any idea what to do with it. According to the whispers, the Obiang family had found a welcome embrace from Riggs. Most importantly, they had found a way to get their money into the U.S. without any questions asked. Not far from Riggs' Washington headquarters, Senator Levin and his staff got wind of the rumors and reports about a relationship between Riggs and the Obiangs. Still at the PSI, Levin was unsatisfied with the recent Patriot Act anti-money laundering legislation he'd spent so much time pushing. Not the language, per se. The prohibitions and proscriptions were as tight as any in the world, but with compliance. A law, after all, is only as effective as its enforcement. And Levin wanted to know, were American banks actually complying with these new regulations? And were the bodies tasked with oversight, the Treasury Department most especially, actually following through? We saw that a journalist had done a piece about Equatorial Guinea and Riggs, one of Levin's investigators remembered. With the alleged connections between Riggs and the Obiangs, Levin's radar just went off. This was it, Levin said. Riggs would be their test case to examine just how effectively those new post-9/11 regulations were working, or if the American banks were still the laundromats processing dirty money tied to these putrid regimes. By March 2003, Levin and his staff began issuing subpoenas, collecting documents, and organizing interviews. In time, they would amass over 100 boxes of packed folders and electronic material, all with thousands of pages of bank statements, wire transfers, and emails, amidst their piling evidence from Riggs. And what they would find in just a year would rock activist communities and political bases from Chile to the United Kingdom, and by 2005, topple Riggs entirely, killing off Washington's most venerable bank for good. When Senate investigators began questioning the bank, Riggs initially attempted to play down its links with Equatorial Guinea. The bank revealed that it maintained a few dozen accounts on behalf of clients from the small nation, but that they were no different than any of the other accounts maintained on behalf of foreign clientele. The first account had been opened in January 1996, shortly after Equatorial Guinea's offshore oil wealth began flowing. But none of the deposits had ever raised any red flags, either then or now, Riggs said. All of the money appeared perfectly above board, the bank claimed. Levin and his staff were hardly convinced. Part of that was due to the nature of the Obiang regime in particular, buttressed as it was by torture, human rights atrocities, and corruption almost without compare. But much of that suspicion also stemmed from a middle-aged Riggs employee named Simon Kareri. In a role similar to Amy Elliott's at Citibank, Kareri had served as the private banker for a number of Riggs' clients, rising to become the bank's senior vice president. When Senate investigators scanned Riggs' accounts, Kareri's name kept popping up, time and again, for account after account after account. When Levin and his staff initially sat down with him, Kareri dodged questions about his role, or about how the relationship between Riggs and Equatorial Guinea began, and even about how the bank had handled the new Patriot Act requirements Levin had forced through. After all, American banks were now prohibited from working with the proceeds of foreign corruption. Given the mountains of evidence against the Obiang family already, how could Kareri and Riggs explain their continued work with them? Riggs, like Kareri, initially defended its ties with the Obiangs. Riggs initially said Kareri was a good guy, one Senate investigator remembered, saying that Riggs claimed they'd never had reason to doubt him and his work. But there was something in the way Kareri had feigned concern, something in the way he slow-walked answers back to the PSI investigators, that only provoked Levin and his staff. The entire staff's shady dealings radar had immediately begun pinging when it came to Kareri, one of Levin's investigators recalled. And it soon became apparent why. Levin's investigators discovered that while Riggs and Kareri had turned over certain information about the Obiang accounts, they had failed to turn over information about dozens more accounts linked to the dictator and his family. Riggs claimed, bizarrely, that their accounting system was still run manually, which was why they'd initially missed the accounts. If true, Riggs would have been the only bank in America without a fully electronic accounting system. As a result, Levin subpoenaed even more documents, this time pertaining specifically to Riggs' anti-money laundering program, which the bank was required to enact following the Patriot Act in order to make sure it wasn't processing foreign corruption proceeds. But as the new documents were coming in, Levin and his staff heard something they didn't expect. Rather than continue to appear for questions with investigators, Kareri had fled the country and had found refuge in Equatorial Guinea. At that point, Riggs immediately flipped on Kareri, pegging him as the fall guy for every misstep that the bank had taken with the Obiangs since the mid-1990s. Riggs at first said Kareri is a good guy, but all of a sudden he fled to Equatorial Guinea, and they did a 180-degree turn, one investigator told me. Kareri turned out to be a bum. The bank's tactics changed almost overnight. Kareri wasn't the reputable, upstanding guy the bank had previously claimed. He was the bad apple, suddenly turned exile. After that, the bank's attorneys rolled over, one investigator remembered. They basically said, whatever you want, you've got. New documents came cascading in. Some revealed Kareri's habit of showing up at Riggs with suitcases of shrink-wrap bills, personally depositing millions of dollars in straight cash on behalf of the Obiangs. Quipped Levin, if that kind of cash deposit does not make a bank sit up and ask questions, I'm not so sure anything will. Other documents detailed meetings set up by Kareri between senior Riggs officials and Obiang's aides, as well as President Obiang himself, with Al Britton, the bank's longtime chief, personally overseeing a committee dedicated to expanding its relationship with the Obiang family. Indeed, the meetings between the Obiangs and the Riggs officials, and Kareri's role therein, were some of the glaringly obvious signs that Riggs knew exactly what it was doing with one of the most corrupt families Africa had ever produced. Once Senate investigators scratched the surface at Riggs, the bank's higher-ups' willingness to do whatever they could to move the Obiangs' money was almost impossible to miss. Much of that has to do with the fact that when it comes to the Obiangs, subtlety is in short supply. Everything about the family's corruption is blindingly obvious. Riggs couldn't simply plead ignorance. But for most American bankers dealing with kleptocrats, for most middle managers, for most tellers, even for most executives, things would never be quite so obvious. Other kleptocratic figures simply blended in with the rest of the high-net-worth clients they were servicing. They could slip their dirty money in with the tides of legitimate finance continually flowing into the country. Differentiating the two was all too often above the pay grade of a banker dealing with dozens of clients per week, difficult to parse, even on the best of days. All of which is to say, if the Obiangs could get away with their dirty money flows at a bank like Riggs for years and years, stopped only by a high-profile Senate investigation, what did other, less conspicuous kleptocrats have to worry about? But it wasn't just Kareri's efforts to funnel as much of Obiang's money as he could to Riggs. As other documents revealed, and as we saw with Citibank and its dirty clients, Riggs' employees had helped Obiang set up several shell companies to further obscure their money on the off chance anyone came looking. The main shell company, called Otong Limited, was registered in the Bahamas in 1999. Time and again, Riggs accepted million-dollar cash deposits meant for the Obiang family on the shell company's behalf, including in 2002, well after the new Patriot Act provisions went into force. Riggs claimed that Otong was an exporter of timber, despite knowing full well that the shell company had no employees and was little more than a front for President Obiang. Riggs' documents also claimed that the Obiang family made their money from cocoa farming and businesses, and didn't say anything about the fact that the family oversaw a horrific dictatorship. Nor was that all. Levin and his staff found that Riggs had additionally opened accounts for payments from American oil companies owed to Obiang and his regime. That is, rather than depositing payments for oil extraction with, say, Equatorial Guinea's treasury, the Obiangs directed the companies to route those millions into their U.S. accounts at Riggs for their personal use, a setup that Riggs facilitated. And that money could then be withdrawn perfectly easily with a simple signature from either President Obiang, who would stop by on his trips to Washington, or from his wayward son. When the tabulations finally stopped and the documents finally ran out, the findings were staggering. From 1995 through 2003, Riggs hosted a mountainous $700 million for the Obiang regime in dozens of different accounts, all of it presumably dirty, made from embezzlement, corruption, and the perks of being a dictator. Riggs allowed the Obiang family to cycle their dirty funds through the bank and withdraw it on the other side as perfectly clean money, complete with the imprimatur of the Bank of Presidents, to be spent on anything they liked. The bank was, in essence, a bottomless ATM for the family. More astonishingly, that total amount made the Obiang regime the largest single client of Riggs Bank. By the early 2000s, Riggs had gone from relying on American presidents and their entourages to leaning heavily on one of the most corrupt regimes on the planet. Perhaps most remarkable, the bank hadn't flagged a single one of the dozens and dozens of accounts as high risk, or subjected them to any additional scrutiny as regulations required. Given the fees the bank charged the Obiangs to host their money, it was best, Riggs decided, not to look a kleptocratic gift horse in the mouth. We have a dictator here who is, according to the reports that you can read and I can read, someone who is a human rights violator and who runs a country as though it is his own private fiefdom, Levin would say in a 2004 hearing on his staff's findings. But I have to tell you, I do not see any fundamental difference between dealing with an Obiang and dealing with a Saddam Hussein. On their face, the stories Levin and his staff unearthed regarding Riggs and Citibank were little different. Both involved private bankers who ran wild with their ludicrously corrupt customers, helping them set up shell companies to cover their tracks, obscuring their ties in public, and making millions while freely processing gobsmacking amounts of dirty foreign money. Like Citibank, Riggs had actively assisted some of the most corrupt customers on Earth. And also like Citibank, Riggs tried to keep the pipeline open as long as it could, no matter the source of the income. There was one difference, though, between Citibank's ties with noxious regimes and foreign crooks and Riggs' transformation into the Obiang's preferred money laundering vehicle, the law. Citibank had gone about its malfeasance before those Patriot Act provisions had placed new restrictions on America's banking sector. Riggs, however, simply pretended that those new restrictions never took place. As Levin later said, Riggs ignored its anti-money laundering obligations before the Patriot Act and continued to ignore them afterward. As Riggs and the Obiangs so clearly illustrated, when an onrush of dirty foreign money floods Washington, it can overcome even the kinds of anti-money laundering laws that have both momentum and public support behind them. As Levin and the PSI learned in their inquiry, Riggs had not only continued processing the Obiang's dirty money through the entire saga of the passage of the Patriot Act, but it hadn't even bothered to flag any of the Obiang-related accounts as high risk until late 2003, well after the first suspicions about the bank's foreign ties began trickling out and after Senate investigators had already begun asking questions. And it soon became clear why. Part of the banking regulations required officials at the Treasury Department to oversee compliance with anti-money laundering procedures. In the case of a client like the Obiangs, those regulations centered on making sure that the bank wasn't servicing the proceeds of foreign corruption, that the accounts the bank held on behalf of foreign officials appeared to match what could be expected of those foreign officials' incomes and assets. And if those at the bank are clearly turning a blind eye, as those at Riggs did time and again with the Obiangs, American regulators, tasked with making sure banks complied with these anti-money laundering procedures, were supposed to clamp down and make sure the new measures were followed. But the American officials in charge of monitoring Riggs weren't simply asleep on the job. They actively swept Riggs' practices under the rug. They, in effect, colluded with Riggs' transformation into a laundromat for the Obiangs. As the Senate investigators uncovered, the U.S. official charged with overseeing Riggs' compliance, known as the Examiner in Charge, EIC, working out of the Treasury Department's Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, OCC, appeared to have become more of an advocate for the bank than an arm's-length regulator. The official, R. Ashley Lee, worked as Riggs' EIC for several years, including through the post-9/11 debates just a few halls away on the U.S.'s new anti-money laundering regulations. For Lee, though, those regulations were apparently little more than suggestions, ones he could freely ignore as he saw fit. Lee apparently thought that because no one had necessarily taken banking regulations seriously before, at least when it came to handling foreign corrupt monies, there was little reason to think they would start now. On multiple instances, Lee recommended against taking any action against Riggs. Even with numerous internal complaints from anti-money laundering bank examiners watching the Obiangs move their money through Riggs, Lee did nothing. As one of Lee's employees wrote him, "Riggs's clear breach of anti-money laundering provisions compels me to formally express my fear of what we have yet to uncover at this bank." Yet Lee kept approving the bank's operations and stalling any disciplinary action every time he had a chance. Lee claimed that the bank had promised to correct identified anti-money laundering deficiencies, and that Riggs was planning to remedy the identified deficiencies. Year after year went by, though, with nothing changing. If that had been all, Lee would have come out of the PSI investigation looking like a dupe, his ineptitude matched only by Riggs's greed. But there was another angle to the relationship, as Levin and his staff uncovered. When Lee announced he was retiring as EIC in 2002, Riggs immediately swooped in and offered Lee a new and lucrative management position. Lee was technically free to take the position, however unseemly it looked from the outside. After all, he'd hardly be the first bureaucrat to capitalize on a cozy relationship with the entity he was supposed to be overseeing. But federal post-employment regulations barred any sit-down meetings between former officials and the bank regulators for at least 2 years, a restriction Lee apparently ignored, appearing almost immediately after he left the government as an official representative of Riggs. Lee, remarkably, didn't deny his presence at these meetings, but his defense bordered on the absurd. As a later Senate report noted, when the PSI asked him about these meetings, Mr. Lee acknowledged attending them, but claimed that he made a deliberate decision not to speak at them so that he would not violate the post-employment ban. In other words, after remaining silent on Riggs's laundering for years, Lee remained silent when he was officially in Riggs's employ. It was a clear case of what's known as regulatory capture, when industry and officials become so cozy with one another that any dividing lines effectively disappear. The relationship between Riggs and Lee was hardly the first example of this happening, but given the hundreds of millions of dollars making up the Obiang's relationship with Riggs, it was perhaps the most expensive instance of regulatory capture in American history. There was one other key discovery in the PSI's deep dive into Riggs, which neither Levin nor any of the members of his staff ever expected to find. With hundreds of boxes, thousands of documents, and even more potential leads to sift through, Levin needed as many hands as he could find for the examination of Riggs. One of those tapped for help was Laura Stuber, known as a dogged PSI forensic investigator. During the inquiry, Stuber spent time combing through some of the account ledgers Riggs had delivered, looking for names that might lead somewhere. There was one that caught her eye. There were some ledgers that said, "Oh, Pinochet," and I said, "Oh, that's interesting," Stuber, now working for the California Attorney General's office, told me. Pinochet, the last name of Augusto Pinochet, the grisly, decades-long military dictator in the South American country of Chile, responsible for the country's 1973 coup and for a regime that killed thousands. Another of Pinochet's claims to fame, launching a successful assassination campaign against political opponents exiled in Washington. But his name didn't begin with an O. Maybe it was a relative or a family member. So Stuber pulled on the thread and immediately discovered that this was no family member. This was the man himself, yet another dictator who'd plowed millions upon millions of dollars into Riggs with no questions asked. Tracing the names and numbers in ledger after ledger, Stuber untangled how Pinochet had bounced his money to and through Riggs, laundering it for his own use since the mid-1990s. As she followed the money he shuffled through different banks, there were scans of different passports the Chilean strongmen used, with photos of him in various disguises, some where he was balding, some where he had a new mustache, some where he was wearing glasses. She also uncovered the different names he'd used to set up the accounts, some with variants of his own name, Augusto Pinochet Ugarte, and some in the names of Chilean military officials who'd helped buttress his brutality. There were, in total, nearly 30 accounts linked directly to the Chilean kleptocrat, all of them allowing him to continue bankrolling his lavish lifestyle after stepping down from the presidency in 1990 and promptly taking office as senator for life in the Chilean legislature. And there, in all their actuarial glory, the bank documents recorded all the ways Riggs had not only sought out Pinochet's ill-gotten money, but had helped him conceal and launder the funds, even while thousands of Pinochet's victims were demanding justice in Chile. As the documents revealed, Riggs specifically recruited Pinochet to the bank, describing his wealth in internal documents as stemming from family and salary. Just a dictator trying to make an honest living, apparently. Carol Thompson, the private banker assigned to Pinochet's accounts, met with the former dictator multiple times a year, with Riggs even providing Pinochet with offshore corporations that helped conceal his financial transfers. Even after Pinochet was finally placed under house arrest in London in 1998, with a British court ordering a freeze of all his assets, Riggs helped Pinochet work around the freeze by transferring his money through shell company accounts to keep it hidden yet accessible. In other words, Riggs helped Pinochet, again, one of the late 20th century's most notorious butchers, known for tossing political opponents out of helicopters, specifically evade a court-ordered asset freeze. And there, over and over, was R. Ashley Lee. Yet again, Lee didn't bother to raise any concerns when he learned that Riggs was catering to Pinochet's financial needs. In one remarkable incident, Lee also excluded all paperwork related to the Pinochet accounts from the OCC's own electronic database, relegating them instead to a single hard copy, effectively making the accounts all but invisible to anyone else in Treasury who may have wanted to take a look. This was about a month before Lee accepted his sparkling new job at Riggs. Remarkably, up until the PSI's findings, Pinochet had somehow escaped developing a reputation for high-level corruption. Chileans viewed him as an authoritarian figure, a bloody impediment to Chile's democratic path, but he was never seen as someone who profited from his position. And then Levin and his staff's findings came out, and that reputation completely crumbled. "We thought he was this modest guy, and it created this huge uproar in Chile," Stuber told me. "We didn't know it was going to have that big an impact. We thought it was a big deal, but didn't know it was that big." But it was. Suddenly, Pinochet's remaining reputation in Chile collapsed in on itself. The facade he'd maintained for decades, that he was interested only in order, not in lining his pockets, crumbled. His corruption was suddenly there for all to see, no longer bundled behind the benefits of American secrecy. As the story dominated Chilean headlines, whatever soft spot Pinochet may have retained among nostalgic Chileans imploded. He had a reputation of being a patriot, or of at least being an honest, ruthless dictator, Levin told me, and we destroyed that. After Levin and his staff finished sorting through the hundreds of boxes and thousands of documents and millions of financial details, the conclusions were stark. Riggs, by the mid-2000s, had transformed into a substantial engine for kleptocracy. Riggs made a mockery of claims that the Patriot Act's new anti-money laundering regulations were sufficient. Without enforcement, and with Treasury banking regulators allowed to jump ship to the banks they were supposed to be monitoring, the new legal restrictions were hardly worth the congressional paper on which they were written. Osama bin Laden boasted that his modern new recruits knew the cracks in the Western financial systems like they knew the lines in their hands, Levin said during a charged 2004 Senate hearing announcing the PSI findings on Riggs and the Obiang's corruption. That chilling statement helped fuel a new effort to strengthen our defenses against terrorists, corrupt dictators, and others who would use our financial systems against us. But the Riggs case history shows we still have a long way to go. Riggs, as it was, wouldn't get a chance to finally implement the reforms Lee had long allowed them to skirt. After coughing up over $40 million in penalties, the largest then in American history, including nearly $10 million to a fund dedicated to the thousands of victims of Pinochet's brutality, Riggs finally shuttered the Obiang-related accounts, divesting itself of its largest client. Shortly thereafter, limping along, Riggs effectively folded, selling out to another American bank. Lincoln's Bank, mortally wounded by the revelations about its money laundering machinery, was finally no more. And yet, almost none of Riggs' higher-ups spent any time in prison. Kareri, who'd christened Riggs' relationship with the Obiangs, pleaded guilty on multiple counts, including bank fraud and money laundering. But even then, he received only a 2-year sentence, not much for a banker responsible for propelling one of the most blatant money laundering schemes ever seen in the nation's capital. Yet that sentence was still more than Lee or Carol Thompson, Pinochet's private banker, received, with both of them getting off scot-free. Albritton, Riggs' longtime head, had already resigned his position in 2002, handing over the bank's stewardship to his playboy son, Robert Albritton, who claimed ignorance of the entire affair. The younger Albritton, now the publisher of Politico, blamed his lack of awareness on the fact that he spent much of the time cavorting and skiing across Europe. In the end, the Riggs story was a bit of American kleptocracy in miniature. Even with the new laws, a member of the American financial sector, Riggs, nonetheless kept working with a series of foreign officials, the Obiangs. On its face, such a relationship mirrored its work for the bank's other clients, many of whom also sought banking security and secrecy. But there was one glaring exception. The Obiangs oversee one of the most brutal regimes on the planet. Yet the bank didn't need to worry, since the American bureaucrats supposedly overseeing the operation were in on the action. And if the American officials didn't care, then who would? The only thing Riggs didn't count on was Levin and his staff finally poking around and making an example of Riggs to the rest of the world. The Obiangs, meanwhile, simply moved on. Their Riggs accounts were no more, but their grip on Equatorial Guinea's surging oil wealth and on the levers of the country's political system never wavered. Instead, they simply sniffed out new outlets for their money laundering enterprises. the hundreds of millions in dirty money they'd piled into rigs was suddenly in search of a new home. And a continent away, Teodorin thought he'd found a solution. Where one avenue closed, a dozen others opened, loopholes there to exploit. So when Levin and his staff finally closed the rigs investigation, Teodorin returned to an old haunt, Southern California. No longer was he simply a student a million miles from home, skipping his lessons and drinking until the early morning hours. Now he was bringing with him an entire fleet of helpers, drivers and housekeepers, estate managers and professional cooks, security teams chock full of retired police officers. And it was there, in California, that Teodorin would plot his next moves for his transnational money laundering enterprise. There, as one contact said, to take full advantage of the loopholes in the Patriot Act, to splurge on as much bling and as many baubles as he could find, and on so much caviar that, as one source told a Harper's in 2009, you could have scooped it with a shovel. Chapter 7. Mensa Certified Genius. We pride ourselves on being a country of asylum for those who have been persecuted or prosecuted, but we've never been a dumping ground for despots or dictators or people who have plundered a nation. Ted Kennedy. While senators held hearings on rigs, Teodorin pulled up outside a 12-foot-high wooden gate in Southern California. Flanking him were a pair of turrets, perfect spots for guards to perch as lookouts. Palm trees leaned overhead, stretching out beyond, swaying slightly. Under a warm sun, Teodorin looked to his right, just past the palm trees, knowing that if he followed the road, he'd find homes that belonged to celebrities like Britney Spears, Mel Gibson, and Kelsey Grammer. But Teodorin wasn't interested in visiting those homes. He wanted the one that was right in front of him. Just behind the gate, a driveway wound on. On the right side, a tennis court sat unused next to a sand-colored guest house. As the driveway continued, the horizon opened up just to the left, and the Pacific Ocean came into view, stretching into the distance. Those who visited the property actually compared the view to an infinity pool. The 16-acre yard's giant, grassy sprawl ended at the edge of a sheer cliff, immediately dropping off, leaving nothing but the view. At the end of the driveway, spread out like an inverted horseshoe, was a building that was less a house than, as visitors said, a palace. Part Spanish mission, part sprawling mansion, the blufftop building had 15,000 square feet of space. 6 bedrooms, 8 bathrooms, a foyer larger than most homes, a hot tub, and actual infinity pool nestled alongside. The closets alone stretched into thousands of square feet. The closet was bigger than my house, one visitor later told me. The home, built in 1991, was fit for a prince. Which is why, when he stopped by for the first time in 2004, Teodorin realized that he had to have this property. Little matter that legislators in Washington were publicly debating his family's corruption. They may as well have been on Mars for all he cared. They couldn't touch him, or his money, or his plans. There was one issue, though. All that money Teodorin had been tapping into at Riggs, all that money his family swindled, money that should have gone to schools and hospitals and roads and libraries, was suddenly marked. Everybody following the news knew his money was dirty. Thanks to Senator Levin's hearings and the fact that Riggs had suddenly become the poster child for housing and laundering dirty money, Teodorin could no longer simply open an account in his own name, wire as much money as he wanted to an American bank, or hand it off in shrink-wrapped millions to an American banker for in-person deposits. He would need help sniffing out new destinations for his money. And for that, he knew just what he needed, an American lawyer. The Patriot Act's anti-money laundering provisions, as we saw earlier, imposed a number of new restrictions on U.S. banks and other financial institutions, and created new money laundering crimes regarding funds gained via foreign corruption. Along with banks, real estate agents, luxury goods vendors, and investment advisors, those running things like hedge funds and private equity firms, had all been targeted by American legislators for strict new anti-money laundering regulations, even though they'd since received temporary exemptions from Patriot Act requirements. But there was one glaring omission from the new requirements: lawyers. Despite playing key roles in scandals like the BCCI implosion, American lawyers never got a mention in the Patriot Act's anti-money laundering provisions. There was no legal requirement for American lawyers to ask clients where they got their money from, or run basic due diligence checks on their clients' dirty money. All that mattered was that their clients, American or otherwise, needed legal services, and the deeper the pockets, the better. In reality, anti-money laundering checks for American lawyers are something of an oxymoron. American lawyers can work with whichever clients they want, providing their services to oligarchs or dictators or anyone with a bit of dirty money waiting to be put to use. The American Bar Association, ABA, the primary professional association representing America's legal industry, has issued multiple guidances for attorneys, instructing them how to avoid handling dirty money or how to avoid getting caught in kleptocratic money laundering networks writ large, how to avoid becoming, as experts describe them, enablers, or those enabling the flow of dirty funds into the U.S. And yet, these best practices remain mere suggestions. They're completely voluntary. There's nothing legally binding about them. U.S. lawyers can choose to comply or not as they wish. It makes no difference in the eyes of American law, or even in their standing within the ABA or other legal associations. Even with other jurisdictions having moved forward to prevent lawyers from handling dirty money, the European Union issued its first directive requiring member countries to impose anti-money laundering policies way back in 1991, America's legal sector remains unchanged, free of any legal anti-money laundering requirements. A 2016 video sting from the anti-corruption organization Global Witness illustrated just how willingly segments of America's legal sector would roll around in the filthy money pouring in. Posing as an advisor to an African minister looking to move millions in suspect dirty money, someone like Teodorin, for instance, Global Witness sat down with a dozen different American lawyers to ask their advice on how best to hide the funds in the U.S. and to see how willing they'd be to do so. "We said we needed to get the money into the U.S. without detection," Global Witness wrote. The results, Global Witness found, were shocking. All but one of the lawyers immediately dove into the details of how best to launder the funds in the U.S. and how to obscure any links to the African minister in question. Setting up anonymous shell companies was, of course, a popular theme. Not only would the links between the shell company and the kleptocrat remain concealed, but if the lawyer was involved in the shell company's creation, there would be the added benefit of attorney-client privilege. Another layer of secrecy, protecting the kleptocrat in question if anyone asked. But some went even further. A number of the lawyers caught on tape suggested funneling the dirty money directly into the law firm's own bank accounts, effectively mixing the dirty money in with the firm's own funds, and offering cover of the law firm as assurance that the money in question was perfectly above board. One unwitting interviewee, James Silkenet, detailed how the African minister could work around the new anti-money laundering checks American banks were supposed to enforce. The key? Having the lawyers identify which banks were still less than enthusiastic about enforcing the anti-money laundering requirements. Silkenet explained that some banks carry out less rigorous checks on their customers, and he said that he had experience at identifying such banks, Global Witness wrote. As Silkenet told them, "We would have to look into how far specific banks look into the Know Your Customer laws and how far they would dig." The kicker? Silkenet was the head of the American Bar Association. Nor were these small-scale firms. Around the same time, the law firms Shearman & Sterling LLP and DLA Piper were intimately involved in a massive billion-dollar Malaysian corruption scheme, and the powerhouse firm Skadden Arps was raking in millions while helping direct shady lobbying efforts out of Ukraine. Small firms, large firms, it didn't seem to matter. All proved more than willing to help their dirty money clients time and again. But again, none of this was illegal. American lawyers remain free to work with whatever clients they want. They can set up shell companies, trusts, or significant purchases for any client. And then, if investigators come knocking, they can claim attorney-client privilege and refuse to reveal any details. It's yet another layer of anonymity and protection to enjoy. In many ways, U.S. lawyers are the perfect friend to have if you're a kleptocrat. The BCCI collapse and the Salinas hearings, the Patriot Act and the resulting Riggs scandal, all of them had upended anti-money laundering realities for American financial institutions. But for American lawyers, almost nothing has changed. which is why when Teodorin started searching out new American uses for his money and for the best way to snap up his Malibu mansion, he sought out lawyers who knew exactly how wide the loopholes for American attorneys remained, and one in particular, a California lawyer named Michael Berger, proved the perfect guide to the remaining and legal loopholes any kleptocrat would need. For those investigators who got to know him, Berger wasn't someone you'd want to spend much time with. He was, at least according to one Senate investigator, a slimeball, someone who, another investigator said, was clearly not a top lawyer. The kind of work Berger seemed to prefer, as one DOJ prosecutor told me, was as unethical as it comes. "That's not why I went to law school," the prosecutor said, reflecting on Berger's work. Berger, though, doesn't seem to mind. With a bulbous forehead and stretched smile, the attorney clearly thinks highly of himself. As the site for his law firm reads, "Mr. Berger is a Mensa, certified genius, with the intellectual ability to craft creative solutions to even the most difficult legal problems." For Teodorin, as later congressional and court documents revealed, there was one other reason Berger was ideal. Berger's willingness to barrel through legal loopholes, to set up all the anonymous shell companies Teodorin would need, and to scour bank after bank for the most lax anti-money laundering enforcement extant, and then uproot for a new bank whenever they caught on, was a perfect fit for an African kleptocrat with dreams of becoming a California superstar. Based in Los Angeles, Berger initially connected with Teodorin in 2004, just as Levin and his colleagues in Washington began blasting rigs and broadcasting the rank corruption rotting the Obiang family's wealth. Yet none of those details or revelations ever seemed to perturb Berger. It's unclear how the two of them first met. Berger declined to comment for this book, citing the privilege between myself and my client. Teodorin told him that there was a property just north of them, perched along the Malibu coastline, fit for a prince, that he wanted, and he wanted Berger to help him get it. So Berger got to work, pocketing hundreds of thousands of dollars, as well as numerous other perks along the way. First, Berger called a neighbor, a real estate agent he'd known since the early 1990s. Neil Badden was a Minnesota native who had worked as a real estate agent in the greater Los Angeles area since 1981. Badden later said he'd never heard of Teodorin before Berger's call and hadn't been closely following the hearings in Washington into the Obiang family's wealth. So when he got a call from Berger, and when Berger told him a wealthy client was looking for someone to help with a delicate and intricate sales transaction, he didn't think twice. Not that there was any reason for him to do so. As we already saw, the Treasury Department had specifically exempted real estate agents like Badden, who at the time worked for the Coldwell Banker Realty firm, from anti-money laundering requirements. As with Berger, there was no legal reason for Badden to check the source of Teodorin's cash flow, to do a due diligence review of him or his family, or even to bother with a cursory Google check. He didn't even need to know Teodorin's identity as his client. Badden would later claim there were no red flags obvious to him. As Badden would tell Senate investigators years later, the real estate agent had no legal obligation to inquire about Teodorin's finances, and such questions made most clients uncomfortable. And he was right. As with the banks before them, for real estate firms, kleptocrats and other high net worth clients could appear little different on paper. Dirty money entered the slipstream of capital flowing into American real estate, often looking indistinguishable from other finances tied to celebrities, to media moguls, to billionaires achieving their American dreams. Real estate agents, thanks to the Patriot Act exemption, were under no compunction to check under the hood of the finances to see if they could track down where it came from and whether their client was actually a kleptocrat searching out their own American dream. Even if they did prod about a client's wealth, they ran the risk that the client would simply look for a different, less curious real estate agent. Plus, what if the client simply used an anonymous shell company? How was the real estate agent supposed to pierce that veil? How was anyone, a real estate agent in California, a banker in Washington, a lawyer filing all the necessary paperwork, supposed to tell if that Delaware shell company behind the purchase was secretly run by a man sitting on billions in ill-gotten gains? And given the amounts of money involved, why would they ever bother to check if there wasn't even a law against it? That October, sitting in a suite at the Beverly Wilshire Hotel, Badden met Teodorin for the first time. Sweeping in with his tailored suit, wide-rimmed glasses, and a model-thin woman on his arm, Teodorin struck him, Badden remembered, as bigger than life, Baden successfully pitched his services to the kleptocrat sitting across from him. A month later, Berger phoned to let Baden know Theodorin wanted to hire him. They drew up a retainer agreement with one goal in mind: obtain the Malibu property. "One of the most extraordinary pieces of property I've ever seen in my life," Baden said. The cost was irrelevant. While Baden got to work carving out an agreement with the Malibu property sellers, Berger had other duties in Theodorin's employ. Theodorin, after all, still needed a way to hide all the dirty money he could no longer keep in rigs. And as with so many others, Berger knew precisely where to turn: anonymous American shell companies. In October 2004, the lawyer filed paperwork to create an anonymous American shell company called Beautiful Vision Incorporated. Not long later, he formed a second anonymous shell company for Theodorin dubbed Unlimited Horizon Incorporated. As Berger and Theodorin both intended, the filings for Beautiful Vision and Unlimited Horizon never once mentioned Theodorin by name. Shortly after Berger helped Theodorin create Beautiful Vision, the lawyer swung by a local branch of Bank of America to open a pair of checking accounts in the shell company's name. According to bank records, Berger identified himself as the shell company's owner and president, and then proceeded to navigate the legal loopholes available to him as Theodorin's lawyer. Theodorin had already transferred significant funds into Berger's own attorney-client account at the bank. Berger then transferred some of those funds from the accounts for his law office, which again had no legal obligation to look into Theodorin's blindingly obvious links to foreign corruption, to the shell company accounts. On paper, it looked like the accounts for Berger's law firm had simply started bankrolling shell company accounts, leaving the bank and those inside the bank on the lookout for potential money laundering, none the wiser about the fund's true origins. In just a few months, Berger helped supply the new accounts with the nearly $10 million needed to pay Theodorin's bills and expenses. Still, with the stench of rigs wafting out of Washington, Bank of America grew skittish and started taking a closer look at the shell company account's activities, which had included a series of substantial cash transfers. Internal auditors scoured the account's transactions and discovered a series of suspicious payments, including stays at hotels in Las Vegas and Hawaii and transfers from Equatorial Guinea. It didn't take long for the bank to realize who was really behind the shell company accounts: Theodorin. Less than a year after their opening, both accounts were shuttered by Bank of America. While the bank later admitted it could have moved more quickly to close the accounts, its anti-money laundering protocols had, on the whole, worked, a testament to the Patriot Act provisions and Carl Levin's efforts in Washington. Except there was one catch. Bank of America allowed Berger to keep his firm's long-standing attorney-client accounts, the ones that had helped funnel millions into the shell company accounts in the first place, open and operating. And even while Bank of America shuttered the shell company accounts, the bank allowed the attorney-client accounts to keep receiving funds, time and again, from Theodorin's accounts in Equatorial Guinea. After all, there was no legislation or regulation requiring the banks to close the attorney-client account. As far as the bank was concerned, they'd followed the letter of the law. The bank closed the shell company accounts, but effectively allowed the rest of the operation to continue as before. That decision, as investigators later discovered, proved the key to keeping Theodorin's entire money laundering operation going. A state-based bank, Union Bank of California, proved just as open. Using the same methods, opening accounts in the names of new shell companies and using the separate law firm accounts at Bank of America as the go-between, Theodorin managed to transfer millions more into his Union Bank of California accounts, and Berger decided to open an account at the new bank for his law firm, initiating yet another stream through which to move the money. Ironically, even though some of the bank's internal auditors flagged a number of the account transactions for review, the bank couldn't act on the questions for months, mainly because the bank was simultaneously negotiating with the Department of Justice over the bank's faulty anti-money laundering systems. Eventually, eyeing the seven-figure sums that kept rolling in and out of the shell company accounts, the bank took a closer look at where the money was coming from and what it was being used for. Sure enough, they concluded that the funds were suspicious. But unlike Bank of America, Union Bank of California specifically singled out Berger for his role. As the bank's own report detailed, the investigation found the use of multiple corporate vehicles by Michael Berger to disguise the identity of Theodorin, as well as layer and integrate funds derived via international wire transactions from a high-risk jurisdiction, Equatorial Guinea, which had the appearance of money laundering activity. The findings couldn't have been starker. Berger had apparently acted as the facilitator of a transnational money laundering scheme. The bank's response was swift, closing all the accounts, including the attorney-client fund in question. Yet Berger and Theodorin were not deterred. There were banks aplenty, all throughout California, to turn to. The two even eyed Citibank, the centerpiece of the Salinas investigations just a few years prior, and opened several new accounts there before the bank realized the accounts were inconsistent with the account profile, closing them before they could do more damage. As court documents later detailed, Berger obfuscated in order to keep the accounts open. As a later complaint filed by the government alleged, when the bank inquired about an account affiliated with Unlimited Horizon, Berger lied that it was to help one of his clients pay a female employee without the client's wife knowing about it. Berger, who kept a file of articles highlighting all the facets of Theodorin's rank corruption, didn't seem to mind his role in helping the kleptocrat move his money. In addition to the six-figure payments Berger earned, documents later revealed that Theodorin had introduced Berger to a lifestyle the lawyer had never known, taking Berger to party after party around Southern California, including one called the Candy Halloween Bash at the Playboy Mansion. In response, Berger couldn't help but gush. "I appreciate the super VIP treatment that you gave me," Berger wrote in one email. "I appreciate you telling your friends that I'm your attorney. I'm proud to work for you. The food was great. The drinks were better than great. The house, the view, the DJ, the White Tiger were all so cool." After the Playboy Bash, Berger blushed. "I had an awesome time. I met many beautiful women, and I have the photos, email addresses, and phone numbers to prove it. If the word gets out that you are looking for a bride, women all over the world will go even more crazy for you. Your loyal friend and attorney, Michael Berger." As a journalist at Forbes later quipped, Berger seemed to enjoy the perks of being a kleptocrat's henchman. Along the way, Theodorin also enlisted the help of a second California lawyer. George Nagler had more pedigree than Berger, having graduated from Harvard, and appeared at least a little more scrupulous than Berger. "Nagler wasn't so personally despicable as Berger," one Senate investigator told me. Nagler even freely admitted to suspicions about the origins of Theodorin's money. As he later told congressional investigators, he was well aware of the suspect origins of Theodorin's funds. But again, there was nothing on the books, no law, no regulation, forcing Nagler, as an American lawyer, to do anything about those suspicions. It was the same story, time and again. There was Nagler, forming a number of American shell companies on Theodorin's behalf, with names like Sweet Pink Incorporated and Sweetwater Malibu LLC. There was Nagler, opening accounts for the new companies at banks both familiar, Union Bank of California, and new, Cal National Bank, City National Bank, Pacific Mercantile Bank. There were the new accounts sucking up millions directly from Equatorial Guinea or via transfers from Nagler's own law firm account, free for Theodorin to use in the U.S. before the banks ever caught on. One of the accounts actually featured rap megastar Eve as the account holder, which makes sense given that, as we'll see in the next chapter, she'd begun dating Theodorin. On and on the process continued. By the time any bank caught on, it was already too late, and there were numerous other banks to run the same scheme through. It was, said one Senate investigator, a cat-and-mouse game, one made infinitely easier by the fact that Berger and Nagler could freely work with whichever clients they wanted, even those embedded in the most barbaric regimes on the planet. "How do they look themselves in the mirror?" Rick Messick, an anti-corruption consultant who spent years trying to track Theodorin's crimes, told me. "How much money does it take?" While Berger and Nagler ran Theodorin's money through a carousel of unsuspecting banks, Baden, Theodorin's real estate agent, was still negotiating with the selling agents at the Malibu Mega Mansion. Given the magnitude of the purchase, Baden wanted to make sure to hew as closely as possible to Theodorin's instructions, but even that was an uphill battle. Not only would Theodorin regularly ignore Baden's phone calls, but there were numerous times when Theodorin would blow off a scheduled meeting with him, forcing Baden to wait for hours to no avail, even when the two were only a single floor apart. Still, Baden pushed on. After bandying millions back and forth, in early January 2006, Baden and the selling agent finally settled on a number all parties could agree to. $30 million for the house, plus an additional $750,000 for some of the furnishings in one of the most spectacular home sales in the U.S. that year. And as with the bankers, as with the lawyers, as with the shell companies, Teodorin got more than just the house. Thanks to American loopholes, he also got to enjoy the anonymity that came with it. As documents later revealed, Teodorin opted to pay for the house with an account attached to one of his anonymous shells, Sweetwater Malibu, LLC. Batten later said that Nagler specifically made sure Teodorin's name never appeared on the deed or title for the house. The selling agent set up an escrow account with First American Title Company, which would then transfer the funds to Wachovia Bank in order to pay the sellers. Escrow is an arrangement in which a third party temporarily houses significant sums of money or assets, typically between buyer and seller. But there again, another loophole. Thanks to the Treasury Department's temporary exemptions, escrow agents, overseeing the escrow accounts, were excepted from any anti-money laundering provisions. Banks still had to run basic anti-money laundering checks on the escrow agents themselves, but after that, with an escrow agent in charge of the account, the oversight ended. Escrow agents could effectively use the Treasury Department's temporary exemption as a magic wand, removing themselves from any obligation whatsoever. The banks, meanwhile, were legally allowed to look the other way and not peek under the hood of the money coming into the escrow account. As later Senate documents revealed, banks' anti-money laundering checks depended upon the escrow agents policing their own clients. But there wasn't a single law forcing those running the escrow accounts to do so. As Wachovia later told investigators, the money came in with no questions asked. It was American kleptocracy in real time. You had an anonymous shell company, a lawyer who didn't need to know anything about his client's finances and industries and tools, in this case, real estate and escrow accounts, that could skirt basic anti-money laundering protocols. Anonymity, legal protections, industries that didn't need to do anything besides cashier checks. What more did a kleptocrat need? Nor was that all. As Batten later revealed, Teodorin forced the real estate agent and all those involved in the purchase to ink a separate confidentiality agreement. Batten was now legally barred from disclosing Teodorin's role in the purchase to anyone. But even then, the agent claimed that the confidentiality agreement was hardly a red flag. He'd signed others in the past, usually for a celebrity type of person. Teodorin, though, appeared to be the first rapacious kleptocrat he'd ever signed one for. In April 2006, the deal closed. Teodorin, who was the subject of high-profile congressional investigations into his corruption, had secured a beautiful house through his American conduits, and he managed to do so legally and anonymously throughout the entire process. Teodorin's marriage of American shell companies and American lawyers and American real estate was, in a sense, as clear a model of American kleptocracy as you could find. And it was a model replicated across the country, all for the benefit of regimes buoyed by corrupt cash. It was the same method that Iranian government officials used to anonymously purchase Manhattan skyscrapers in order to skirt sanctions. It was the same method kleptocratic Venezuelan oligarchs used to anonymously purchase South Florida luxury properties, and crooked Nigerian politicos used to inject dirty money into Houston's housing market. It was the same method the spawn of dictators in Uzbekistan and Gambia and the Republic of Congo used to launder their corrupt wealth up and down America's coastlines, and a method that included, as we'll see in the final section, Trump properties. It was the same method that saw billions and billions of dollars race into America's housing market over the past two decades, inflating prices for the rest of us, allowing these human rights abusers to freely enjoy the fruits of their brutality. At last, with his Malibu mansion in his pocket, the road to celebrity was wide open for Teodorin. He immediately began plotting out his next steps on his parade to stardom. And he promptly began staffing up, creating a hive of activity around the Malibu property, bringing in dozens of waiters and cleaners and employees who could fill out the place and who, on Teodorin's instructions, would form a standing line to applaud him every time he left the house and every time he returned. It was almost as if the Riggs hearing, which had revealed his family's gross corruption just 18 months prior, had never happened. But while Teodorin started leading the life of American royalty he'd long sought, a federal investigator, thousands of miles away in South Florida, was sitting at his breakfast table, flipping through a newspaper. There, on one of the lifestyle pages, something caught his eye. Something curious about an African prince snatching up as many Rolexes as he could find. It was a moment that sparked a pursuit that would, a decade later, result in the Malibu mansion changing hands once again and finally snuffing out Teodorin's American kleptocracy dreams for good.